Smith did not feel justified in taking a day off to hunt until they had conquered Hopeless Pass, but he kept hoping for another chance shot. Maybe now.
Fritz, Lady Macbeth, here.
The dogs trotted up and waited.
High sentry, Loper, Prairie Goat, up.
The dogs immediately got on the very top of the lead wagon, making it in two jumps and a scramble, step, seat, and curved top. There they split the duty, nigh side and off side, and there they would stay until told to get down. Smith had paid a stiff price for the pair, but he had known they were good dogs. He had picked their ancestors on Earth and had fetched them with the first wave. Smith was not a doggy man in any fanatic sense. He simply believed that a partnership that had lasted so long on Earth would serve men equally well on strange planets. Dora was sobered by her husband's words, but once she got busy working, she cheered up. Shortly, while trying to plan a menu from little choice and without a cooking fire, she came across something that vexed her. Good for her as it displaced her worrisome thoughts. Besides, she did not really believe that her husband could fail at anything. She came around the end of the second wagon, crossed the little crawl to where her husband was making sure that his fence was tight.
"Oh, that pesky little rooster!"
Woodrow looked around.
"Honey looked cute in just a sunbonnet."
"Not just a sunbonnet, I'm wearing boots, too. Don't you want to hear what that nasty little rooster did?"
"I'd rather discuss how you look. Adorable, that is. Nevertheless, I'm not pleased with the way you are dressed."
"What? But it's so hot, dear. Since I can't wash, I thought an air bath might make me smell better."
"You smell good to me. But an air bath is a good idea. I'll peel down, too. Your gun, dear? Where's your belt with your knife and gun?"
He started shucking his overalls.
"You want me to wear my gun belt now, inside the fence, with you here to protect me?"
"A self-discipline and a standard precaution, my lovely one."
He hitched his own gun and knife belt back into place as he stepped out of his overalls, and pulled off boots and shirt, and got bare, save for the belt and three other weapons that did not show when he was dressed.
"In more years than I like to think about, I have never been unarmed except when locked in somewhere safe. I want you to acquire the habit. Not just sometimes, always."
"All right. I left my belt on the seat. I'll get it. But Woodrow, I'm not much of a fighter at best."
"You're fairly accurate with that needle gun up to 50 meters. And you're going to get better and better the longer you live with me. Not just with it, but with anything that shoots, cuts, burns, or even makes nasty bruises, from your bare hands to a blaster. See over there, Adorable?"
He pointed to nothing but flatness.
"In just 7 seconds, a horde of hairy savages will come pouring over the top of that rise and attack. I get a spear through my thigh and go down. Then you have to fight them off for both of us. What are you going to do, you poor little girl, with your gun clear over there on the seat of that wagon?"
"Why..."
She set her feet apart, put her hands back of her head, and gave a wiggle that was invented in the Garden of Eden, or perhaps just outside.
"I'll go this way, Adam."
"Yes," Lazarus agreed thoughtfully. "That should work. If they were human, but they aren't. Their only interest in tall, beautiful brown-eyed girls is to eat them, bones and all. Silly of them, but that's how they are."
"Yes, dear," she said, docilely.
"I'll go put on my gun belt. Then I'll kill the one who speared you. Then I'll see how many more I can get before they eat me."
"That's right, Durable Dorable. Always take an honor guard with you. If you have to go, go down fighting. The size of your guard of honor determines your status in hell."
"Yes, dear. I'm sure I'll enjoy hell if you're there, too."
She turned to fetch her weapons.
"Oh, I'll be there. They wouldn't take me anywhere else. Dora, when you put on your gun belt, take off your sunbonnet and boots, and put on your rubies. All of them."
She paused with a foot on the step of the wagon.
"My rubies, dear? Out here on the prairie?" Rangilil, I bought those rubies for you to wear, and for me to admire you wearing them. She flashed a smile that turned her normally serious expression into sunshine, swung on up into the wagon, and disappeared. She was back quickly, wearing weapons, belt, and rubies, but had taken a few seconds to comb her hair, long and chestnut brown and shining. That she had not been able to bathe for more than 2 weeks did not show, did not detract from her enchanting, youthful beauty. She paused on the step and smiled at him.
"Hold it," he said.
"Perfect.
Dora, you are the most beautiful thing I have ever seen in all my born days."
She flashed him another smile. "I don't believe that, my husband, but I hope you will go on saying it."
"Madam, I cannot tell a lie. I say it only because it is the simple truth. Now, what were you saying about the little rooster?"
"Oh, that perverted little monster. I said he had been breaking eggs on purpose. This time I caught him, pecking them. Two freshly laid broken eggs."
"Royal prerogative, dear. Afraid one of them would hatch out a rooster."
"I'll wring his neck. If we had a fire, I'd do it right now. Darling, I was trying to see what we could eat cold without opening anything not already open, and it occurred to me that salt crackers crumbled into raw eggs would almost make a meal. But there were only 3 eggs today, and he broke the 2 laid by his hens. I put plenty of grass in both cages. The 1 egg on the other side wasn't even cracked. Damn him. Woodrow, why do we have 2 roosters?
"For the same reason I carry 2 throwing knives. Sweetheart, after we arrive and hatch our first chicks, once they're big enough that I'm certain of a spare rooster, we can have rooster and dumplings with him as guest of honor, not before."
"But we can't have him breaking eggs. Tonight's supper will be mostly cheese and hardtack, unless you want me to open something."
"Let's not rush it. Fritz and Lady Mac are trying to spot game right now. Prairie goat, I hope. Loper, if not."
"But I can't cook meat. You said. You did say."
"Raw, my dear. Haunch of prairie goat chopped fine and spread on hard crackers. Beef tartare a la New Beginnings. Tasty. Tastes almost as good as girl."
He smacked his lips.
"Well, if you can eat it, I can eat it. But half the time, Woodrow, I don't know whether you're joking or not." "I never joke about food or women, Dorval. Those are sacred subjects."
He looked her up and down again.
"Speaking of women, woman, dressing you in rubies is just right. But why a bracelet around your ankle?"
"Because you gave me 3 bracelets, sir, as well as rings and a pendant. And you said wear all of them."
"So I did. Where did this one come from?"
"Hey, that's not a ruby, that's me."
"Looks like a ruby. Here's another just like it."
Maybe I'd better take my rubies off so we won't lose them. Or should we water the mules first?"
"You mean before we eat?"
Yes. I guess that's what I mean. Tease.
"You're not speaking very plainly, little Dora. Tell Uncle Gibby what you want."
"I'm not little Dora. I'm Rangy Lil, the horniest girl south of separation. You said so yourself. I cuss, and I swear, and I spit between my teeth, and I'm concubine to Lazarus Long, super stud of the stars, and better than any 6 men. And you know damn well what I want. And if you pinch my nipples again, I'm likely to trip you and take it. But I guess we ought to water the mules."
"Minerva, Dora was just plain nice to be around. Always. It wasn't her physical beauty, which wasn't that outstanding by the usual criteria in any case, although she was utterly beautiful to me. Nor was it her enthusiastic interest in sharing Eros, although she was indeed enthusiastic, ready any time and always on a short fuse. And skilled at it, and got more so. Sex is a learned art, as much so as ice skating or tight wire walking or fancy diving. It is not instinct. Oh, 2 animals couple by instinct. But it takes intelligence and patient willingness to turn copulation into a high and lively art. Dora was good at it, and got better and better, always eager to learn, free of fetishes or silly preconceptions.
patiently willing to practice anything she learned or was taught, and with it that spiritual quality that turned sweaty exercise into a living sacrament. But Minerva, love is what still goes on when you are not horny. Dora was good company at any time, but the tougher things were, the better companion she was. Oh, she fretted about broken eggs because chickens were her responsibility. She did not complain that she was thirsty. Instead of nagging me to do something about that rooster, she figured out what had to be done and did it. Shoved all the hens in with the other rooster, tied the feet of the egg breaker, and laid him aside while she moved the partition between the cages. Then the smaller rooster was in solitary confinement, and we lost no more eggs. But the truly tough parts lay ahead of us. She did not fret at all during those, or ever turn balky when I did not have time to explain. Minerva, much of the trek was slow death. Other parts were sudden dangers that could have been quick death. She was endlessly patient in the former, always kept her head, and helped in the latter. Dear, you are awesomely learned, but you are a city girl, and you've always been on a civilized planet. Perhaps I'd better explain some things. Maybe you would have been asking yourself, is this trip necessary? And if it is, why do it the hard way? Necessary, having done something a Howard should never do, namely marry an ephemeral. I had three choices. Take her to live among Howards. Dora rejected that, although I would have tried to talk her out of it if she had said yes. A short-timer alone in a community of the long-lived is almost certain to go into suicidal depression. I had seen it first in my friend Slayton Ford, and I've seen it many times since. I did not want this to happen to Dora. Whether the number of her years was 10 or 1,000, I wanted her to enjoy them. Or we could stay in Top Dollar, or the same thing, near one of the villages of that small piece of the planet that was settled in. I almost chose this, as the Bill Smith Dodge would work for that, for a time. But only for a short time. The few Howards on New Beginnings, the Magees, and three other families, as I recall, had all arrived incognito, masquerade in Howard jargon. And by simple dodges, they could shuffle things around and never be caught at it. Grandmother Magee could die, then show up as Deborah Simpson on another Howard homestead. The more people there were on the planet, the easier it was to pull this, especially after the fourth wave arrived. All of them cold sleep cargo and thereby never having gotten acquainted with each other. But Bill Smith was married to an ephemeral. If I stayed around to settle parts, I would have to be most careful to keep my hair dyed. Not just on my head, but all over my body, lest some accident give me away. And then be careful to age as fast as my wife did. Worse, I would have to avoid people who had known Ernest Gibbons well. Most of Top Dollar, that is to say. Or someone would see my profile and hear my voice and start wondering, as I had no chance for plastic surgery or anything of that sort. At other times, when it was needful to change name and identity, I had always changed location as well, that being the only foolproof way to do it. Even plastic surgery won't disguise me very long. I regenerate too easily. I once had my nose bobbed. The alternative seemed to involve having my neck bobbed. 10 years later, it was just as it is now, big and ugly. Not that I was too jumpy about being disclosed as a Howard, but if I was going to have to live in masquerade, the more carefully I used these cosmetic tricks, the more Dora's nose would be rubbed in the fact that I was different from her. Different in the saddest way of all. A husband and a wife who ran on very different time rates. Minerva, it seemed to me that the only way I could give my pretty new wife a square shake was by taking her far away from both sorts of people, long-lived and short, where I could quit pretending and we could ignore the difference, forget it, and be happy. So I decided to take her clear out of reach of other people. Decided this before we got back to town the very day I married her. It seemed the best answer to an otherwise impossible situation, but one not as irreversible as a parachute jump. If she got too lonely, if she grew to hate the sight of my ugly mug,
I could bring her out to the settlements again, still young enough to hook another husband. I had this in mind, Minerva. If some of my wives are young enough to hook another husband. I had this in mind, Minerva. If some of my wives have grown tired of me fairly quickly. I had arranged with Zach Briggs. At the same time, I had arranged with John Magee to act as factor for Zach. Arranged with Zach to ask John what had happened to Bill Smith and the little schoolmarm. It was possible that I would need a ride off-planet someday. But why didn't I have Zach put us down on the spot, on the map I had picked as being our likely place of settlement, with everything we would need to start farming and thereby avoid a long, dangerous trek? Not risk death by thirst or by lopers or the treacheries of mountains or whatever. Minerva, this was a long time ago, and I can explain only in terms of technology available there and then. The Andy J could not land. She received her overhauls in orbit around Secundus or some other advanced planet. Her cargo boat could land on any big flat field, but required a minimum of a radar corner reflector to home on. Then had to have many metric tons of water to lift off again. The captain's gig was the only boat in the Andy J capable of landing anywhere a skilled pilot could put her down, then lift off without help. But her cargo capacity was about 2 postage stamps, whereas I needed mules and plows and a load of other things. Besides, I needed to learn how to get out of those mountains by going into them. I could not take Dora into there without being reasonably sure that I could fetch her out again. Not fair. It's no sin not to be pioneer mother material, but it is tragic for both husband and wife to find out too late. So we did not do it the hard way. We did it the only way for that time and place. But I have never put the effort into a mass calculation for a spaceship at liftoff that I put into deciding what to take, what to do without for that trek. First, the basic parameter. How many wagons in the train? I wanted 3 wagons so badly I could taste it. A 3rd wagon would mean luxuries for Dora, more tools for me, more books and such for both of us, and best, a pre-cut, 1-room house to get my pregnant bride out of the weather almost instantly at the other end. But 3 wagons meant 18 mules hauling, plus spare mules. Add 6 by rule of thumb, which meant half again as much time spent harnessing and unharnessing, watering the animals, taking care of them otherwise. Add enough wagons and mules, and at some point your day's march is 0. One man can't handle the work. Worse, there would be places in the mountains where I would have to unshackle the wagons, move them 1 at a time to a more open place, go back for each wagon left behind, bring it up, a process that could take twice as long for a 3-wagon train as for a 2-wagon one. And would happen oftener, even much oftener, with 3 wagons than with 2. At that rate, we might have 3 babies born en route instead of getting there before our first one was born. I was saved from such folly by the fact only 2 trekking wagons were available in New Pittsburgh. I think I would have resisted temptation anyhow, but I had with me in the light wagon we drove from Top Dollar the hardware for 3. Then I spent that extra hardware on other things, bartering it through the Wainwright. I could not wait while he built the 3rd wagon. Both the season of the year and the season of Dora's womb gave me deadlines I had to meet. There is much to be said for just 1 wagon. Standard equipment over many centuries and on several planets for 1 family in overland migration. If they travel in a party. I've led such marches. But 1 wagon by itself, 1 accident can be disaster. 2 wagons offer more than twice as much to work with at the other end, plus life insurance on the march. You can lose 1 wagon, regroup, and keep going. So I planned for 2 wagons, Minerva, even though I had Zach debit me with 3 sets of Stoga hardware, then did not sell that 3rd set until the last minute. Here's how you load a wagon train for survival. First, list everything you expect to need and everything that you would like to take. Wagons, spare wheels, spare axles, mules, harness, spare hardware and harness leather, saddles, water, food, clothing, blankets, weapons,
ammunition, repair kit, medicines, drugs, surgical instruments, bandages, books, plows, harrow, field rake, shovels, hand rakes, hose, cedars, 3, 5, and 7 tine forks, harvester, blacksmith tools, carpentry tools, iron cook stove, water closet, self-flushing type, oil lamps, windmill and pump, sawmill run by wind power, leather working and harness repair tools, bed, table, chairs, dishes, pots, pans, eating and cooking gear, binoculars, microscope, water testing kit, grindstone, wheelbarrow, churn, buckets, sieves, assorted small hardware, milch cow and bull, chickens, salt for stock and for people, packaged yeast, yeast starter, seed grain, several sorts, grinder for whole grain flour, meat grinder. Now don't stop there, think big. Never mind the fact that you've already overloaded a much longer wagon train. Search your imagination. Check the manifests of the Andy J. Search the ship itself. Look over the stock in Rick's general store. Talk with John Magee and look over his house and farm and outbuildings. If you forget it now, it's impossible to go back for it. Musical instruments, writing materials, diaries, calendars, baby clothes, layettes, spinning wheel, loom, sewing materials, sheep, tannin and leather curing materials and tools, clocks, watches, root vegetables, rooted fruit tree seedlings, other seed, etc., etc., etc. Now start trimming. Start swapping. Start figuring weights. Cut out the bull, the cow, the sheep. Substitute goats with hair long enough to be worth cutting. Hey, you missed the shears. The blacksmith shop stays but gets trimmed down to an anvil and minimum tools. A bellows you must make. In general, anything of wood is scratched, but a small supply of wrought iron stock, heavy as it is, must be hauled. You'll be making things you didn't know you could. The harvester becomes a scythe with handle and cradle. 3 spare blades. The field rake is scratched. The windmill stays, and so does the sawmill. Surprise. But only as minimum hardware. You won't tackle either one soon. Books. Which of those books can you live without, Dora? Have the amount of clothing. Double up on shoes, and add more boots, and don't forget children's shoes. Yes, I know how to make moccasins, mukluks and such. Add waxed thread. Yes, we do have to have block and tackle and the best glass and plastic lines we can buy, or we won't get through the pass. Money is nothing. Weight and cubage are all that count. Our total wealth is what mules can take through that notch. Minerva, it was lucky for me, lucky for Dora, that I was on my 6th pioneering venture, and that I had planned how to load spaceships many years before I ever loaded a covered wagon. For the principles are the same. Spaceships are the covered wagons of the galaxy. Get it down to the weight the mules can haul. Then chop off 10% no matter how it hurts. A broken axle, when you can't replace it, might as well be a broken neck. Then add more water to bring it up to 95%. The load of water drops off every day. Knitting needles. Can Dora knit? If not, teach her. I've spent many a lonely hour in space knitting sweaters and socks. Yarn? It'll be a long time before Dora can tease goat shearings into good yarn, and she can knit for the baby while we travel. Keep her happy. Yarn doesn't weigh much. Wooden needles can be made. Even curved metal needles can be shaped from scraps. But pick up both sorts from Rick's store. Oh, my God, I almost mistaken an axe. Axe heads and one handle. Brush hook, pickmatic. Minerva, I added and trimmed and discarded and weighed every item at New Pittsburgh, and we weren't 3 kilometers out of there, headed for separation, before I knew I had us overloaded. That night we stopped at a homesteader's cabin, and I traded a new 30-kilo anvil for his 15-kilo one. Traded even, with a pound of flesh
nearest my heart, tossed in for good measure. I swapped other heavy items that we would miss later for a smoked ham and a side of bacon and more corn for the mules, the last being emergency rations. We lightened the loads again at separation, and I took another water barrel and trayed and filled it because I now had room for another and knew that too heavy a load of water was self-correcting. I think that extra barrel saved our lives. The patch of green that Lazarus Woodrow had pointed out up near the notch of Hopeless Pass proved to be farther away in travel time than he had hoped. On the last day that they struggled toward it, neither man nor mule had had anything to drink since dawn the day before. Smith felt lightheaded. The mules were hardly fit to work. They plodded slowly, heads down. Dora wanted to stop drinking when her husband did. He said to her, "Listen to me, you stupid little tart. You're pregnant, understand me? Or will it take a fat lip to convince you? I held out 4 liters when we served the mules. You saw me."
"I don't need 4 liters, Woodrow."
"Shut up. That's for you and the nanny goat, and the chickens, and the cats. Cats don't take much. Dorable, that much water means nothing split among 16 mules. But it will go a long way among you small fry."
"Yes, sir. How about Mrs. Porky?"
"Oh, that damn sow. Oh, I'll give her 0.5 liter when we stop tonight, and I'll serve her myself. She's likely to kick it over and take your thumb off, the mood she's in. And I'll serve you myself, measure it out, and watch you drink it."
But after a long day, and a restless night, and then an endless day, they were at last among the first of the trees. It seemed almost cool, and Smith felt that he could smell water somewhere. He could not see any.
"Buck! Oh, Buck, circle!"
The boss mule did not answer. He had not talked all day. But he brought the column around, cornered the wagons, and nudged the lead pair into the V to be unharnessed. Smith called the dogs and told them to hunt for water, then started unharnessing. Silently, his wife joined him, serving the off-mule of each pair while Smith cleared the nigh-mule. He anticipated her silence. Dora was, he thought, telepathic to emotions.
"Now, if I were water somewhere around here, where would I be? Which for it, or search the surface first?"
He felt fairly sure that no stream led away from this stand of trees, but he could not be certain without hiking all the downhill side. Saddle Beulah? Shucks, Beulah was worse off than he was. He started unlashing rolled sections of spike fence from the side to the second wagon. He had not seen a loper for 3 days, which meant to him that they were 3 days closer to their next trouble with the beasts.
"Dora, if you feel up to it, you can give me a hand with this."
She made no comment on the fact that her husband had never before let her help erect the crawl. She simply worried about how drawn and tired he looked, and thought about the 0.25 liter of water she had stolen and hidden. How could she persuade him to drink it? They were just done when Fritz set up an excited yipping in the distance.
"Minerva, it was a water hole, a trickle that came out of a rocky face, ran a couple of meters and formed a pool with no outlet. None that time of year, I should say, as I could see where it overflowed in flood season. I could see also plenty of animal sign, loper tracks and prairie goat and more that I could not identify. I had a feeling there might be eyes on me, and I tried to grow eyes in the back of my head. It was dusky near the spring. Trees and undergrowth were thicker, and the sun was getting low. I was in a dilemma. I don't know how it happened that one of the free mules had not found this hole as soon or sooner than the dogs. Mules can smell water. But mules were certain to be there soon, and I did not want them to drink too fast. Sensible as a mule is, he'll drink too fast and too much if he is very thirsty. These mules were extremely thirsty. I wanted to watch each one myself, not let one founder. Besides that, I did not want them walking into that pool. It was clear. Seemed clean. The dogs finished drinking,
I looked at Fritz and wished that he could talk as well as a mule. Did I have anything to ride on? No, not a darn thing. If I told him to fetch Dora, Fritz would try, but would she come? I told her flatly to stay in the crawl till I got back. Minerva, I wasn't thinking straight. The heat and no water had got to me. I should have given Dora contingency instructions, because if I stayed away too long and it started to get dark, she was going to come looking for me no matter what. Hell, I hadn't even fetched a bucket. In the meantime, I at least had sense enough to scoop up and drink a couple of handfuls of water, Gideon style. That seemed to clear my head some. I dropped the straps of my overalls, got my shirt off, soaked it in water, and gave it to Fritz. Find Dora. Fetch Dora, fast. I think he thought I'd gone nuts, but he left, carrying that wet shirt. Then the first mule showed up. Old Buck, praise Allah. And I ruined a hat. That hat Zack had fetched as a present for me. It was alleged to be an all-weather hat, so porous it would let air in, yet so water-repellent that it would keep your head dry in a pouring rain. The former allegation was only moderately true. The latter I had not had a chance to test. Buck snorted and was all for going into the water up to his knees. I stopped him. Then I offered him a hat full of water, then a second, and a third. Enough for now, Buck. Assembly. Water call. With his throat wet, Buck could do it. He let out a trumpeting bellow that was mule talk, not English, and I won't attempt to reproduce it, but it meant line up for water and nothing else. Fall in to be harnessed was another sort of bellow. Then I was trying to cope with a dozen odd, thirst-crazed mules, but between me, Buck, Beulah, who was Buck's straw boss, Lady Macbeth, who was used to helping Buck, too, and a hat that wasn't quite all that waterproof, we made it. I never did learn how seniority was established among mules, but the mules knew, and Buck enforced it, and water call always found them queued up in the same order, and heaven help the youngster who tried to crowd in out of turn. The least he could expect was a nipped ear. By the time the last had been given a hat full of water, my hat was a mess. But here came Dora with Fritz, her needle gun in her right fist, and glory be, two buckets in her left hand. Water call, I told my top sergeant. Line him up again, Buck. With two buckets and two of us working, we got a full bucket into each mule pretty rapidly. Then I got my shirt back from Fritz, scrubbed out the buckets a bit, filled them, and announced a third water call, telling Buck to let them drink from the pond. He did so, but he still maintained discipline. As Dora and I left, each with a bucket of water in one hand and a drawn gun in the other, Buck was still requiring them to drink one at a time by seniority. It was nearly sundown when Dora and I and the dogs got back to the wagons, almost full dark as we finished watering goats and sow and cats and chickens. Then we celebrated. Minerva, I swear solemnly, on the half bucket of water we saved for ourselves, Dora and I got stinking drunk. Despite earlier resolutions not to stop short of the pass, we bivouacked there 3 days, but very useful days. The mules grazed steadily and filled out. Plenty of water, plenty of forage. I shot a prairie goat at the water home. What we couldn't eat, Dora sliced and dried as jerky. I filled all the barrels. Not as easy as it sounds, as Buck and I had to work out a route to the water hole. Then I had to chop some. Then I had to take the wagons in one at a time. It took me a day and a half. But we had cooked fresh meat and all we could eat. And hot baths with soap, with shampoos, with a shave for me. I carried Dora's big iron kettle to the pool. She fetched a bucket. I built a fire. Then we took turns getting the stink off, one guarding while the other washed. When we rolled toward the pass the morning of the fourth day, we were not only in fine shape, but Dora and I smelled good and kept telling each other so in high spirits. We were never again short of water. There was snow somewhere above us, You could feel it in the breeze and sometimes catch a distant glimpse of white in a saddle between peaks. The higher we got, the oftener we encountered rivulets. Water that never reached the prairie in so dry a year. The forage was green and good. We stopped in a little alp close to the pass. There I left Dora with the wagons and the mules and with flat-footed instructions about what to do in case I did not come back. I expect to be back by dark. If I am not, you can wait a week. No longer. Understand me?
I understand you.
All right. At the end of the week, lighten the first wagon by chucking out anything you can do without on trek. Put all food into that wagon. Empty the barrels in the second wagon and put them in the first wagon. Turn the sow and the chickens loose and head back. Fill all your barrels at that trickle we crossed earlier today. After that, don't stop for anything. Roll all day from dawn till dark. You should reach separation in half the time it took us to get up here, okay?
No, sir.
Minerva, a few centuries earlier I would have started to boil up at that point. But I had learned. It took me about a tenth of a second to realize that I could not make her do anything if I were gone, and that a promise made under duress won't hold. All right, Dora. Tell me why not, and what you intend to do instead. If I don't like it, perhaps we both will start back for separation.
Woodrow, while you did not say so, you are asking me to do what I should do, and I would do, if I were a widow.
I nodded. Yes, that's right, dearest. If I'm not back in a week, you're a widow. No possible doubt.
I understand that. I also understand why you are leaving the wagons here. You can't be sure that you can turn them around higher up.
Yes, that's probably what happened to earlier parties. Reached a place where they couldn't go forward and couldn't turn around, then tried one or the other and went over.
Yes. But my husband, you mean to be gone only one day. Half a day out, half a day back. Woodrow, I won't assume that you are dead. I can't.
She looked at me steadily and her eyes filled with tears, but she did not cry.
I must see your dear body. I must be certain. If I am certain, I will go back to separation as fast and as safely as possible. And then go to the Magi's, as you have told me, and have your child and bring him up to be as much like his father as possible. But I must know.
Dora, Dora, in 1 week you will know. No need to look for my bones.
May I finish, sir? If you aren't back tonight, I'm on my own. At dawn tomorrow, I start out on Betty, with another saddle mule following. At noon, I turn back. Perhaps if I can't find you, I'll find a spot higher up where I can take one wagon and turn it around. If I can find such a spot, I'll move one wagon up and use it as a base and look farther. I could have missed your track. Or I might have followed mule tracks. But you aren't on the mule. Whatever it is, I'll search and search again until there's no hope at all. Then I will go to separation as fast as mules can get me there. But my darling, if you are alive, maybe with a broken leg, but alive, if you still have a knife or even your bare hands, I don't believe that a loper or anything can kill you. If you are alive, I'll find you. I will. So I backed down and checked watches with her and agreed on what time I would turn back. Then Buck and I, with me up on Beulah, set out to scout ahead. Minerva, at least 4 parties had tried that pass. None had come back. I'm certain enough that they each failed from being too eager. Not patient enough, unwilling to turn back when the risk was too great. Patience, I have learned. Centuries may not give a man wisdom, but he acquires patience, or he doesn't live through them. That first morning we found the first spot that was too tight. Oh, someone had blasted there and probably got around that turn, but it was too narrow to be safe, so I blasted some more. Nobody in his right mind takes a wagon into the mountains without dynamite or some such. He can't nibble at solid rock with a toothpick, or even a pickaxe, without risking being still up there when the snows come. I was not using dynamite. Oh, anyone with a modicum of chemistry can make both dynamite and black powder, and I plan to do both. Later.
What I had with me was a more efficient and more flexible blasting jelly, and not shock-sensitive, perfectly safe in wagon and saddlebag. I placed that first charge in a crack where I thought it would do the most good, set the fuse but did not light it, then walked both mules back around the bend and exerted my histrionic talent to its limit to explain to Buck and Beulah that there was going to be a loud noise, a bang, but it could not hurt them, so don't worry. Then I went back, lit the fuse, hurried back to them, and was in time to have an arm on each neck. Watched my watch. "Now," I said, and the mountain obliged me with kaboom. Beulah shivered but was steady. Buck said, inquiringly, "Pang?" I agreed. He nodded and went back to cropping leaves. We three went up and took a look. Nice and wide now. Not very level, but three tiny blasts took care of that. "What do you think, Buck?" He looked carefully up and down the trail. "Do wagon?" "One wagon." "Okay." We explored a little farther, planned the next day's work. Then I turned back at the time promised. I was home early. It took me a week to make a couple of kilometers safe to another little alp, a grassy pocket big enough to turn one wagon around at a time. Then it took all of a long day to move our wagons, one at a time, to this next base. Someone had made it that far. I found a broken wagon wheel, salvaged the steel tire and the hub. It went on that way, day after day, slowly, tediously, and at last we were through the notch and headed, mostly, downhill. But that was worse, not better. The river I'd been sure was there, by photo maps from space, was far below us, and we still had to go down, 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 and follow it a long way before we would reach the place where the gorge opened out into a valley suitable for homesteading. More blasting, lots of brush chopping, and sometimes I had to blast trees. But the nastiest part was rappelling those wagons down the steepest places. I didn't mind steep places going uphill, which we still encountered. A 12-mule team can drag a single wagon up any slope they can dig their hooves into. But downhill? Certainly those wagons had brakes. But if the grade is steep, the wagon slides on its tires, then goes over the edge, mules and all. I couldn't let that happen even once. Not ever risk letting it happen. We could lose one wagon and six mules and still go on. But I was not expendable. Dora would not be in the wagon. If that wagon cut loose, my chances of jumping clear would be so-so. If the grade was steep enough to give me even a trace of doubt that I could hold a wagon with its brakes, we did it the hard way. Use that expensive imported line to check it down such pitches. Laid the line out fair and free for running, past the bitter end three times around a tree, stout enough to anchor it, secure it to the rear axle. Then our four steadiest mules, Ken and Daisy, Bo and Belle, would take the wagon down at a slow walk, no driver, following Buck, while I kept tension on the line, paying it out very slowly. If terrain permitted, Dora on Betty would take station halfway down to relay orders to Buck, but I could not permit her to be on the trail itself. If that line parted, it would whip. So maybe half the time Buck and I worked without liaison, doing it dead slow and depending on his judgment. If there was not a sound anchor tree properly positioned, and it seemed to me that this happened more often than not, then we had to wait while I worked something out. This could be anything. A sling between two trees, then rig a fair lead to a third tree. A bare rock anchor using driven pitons. I hated these as I had to do my checking right at the rear axle, walking behind, and God help us all if I stumbled. Then that was always followed by the time-consuming chore of salvaging those pitons. The harder the rock, the better the anchor, but the tougher the job of getting them out, and I had to get them out. I would need them farther along. Sometimes no trees and no rock, Once the anchor was 12 mules, faced back along the trail, with Dora soothing them while I checked at the rear axle and Buck controlled the progress. On the prairie, we often made 30 kilometers a day. Once we were through Hopeless Pass and had started down the gorge, the distance made good over the ground could be zero for days on end. Then up to as high as 10 kilometers if there were no steep pitches that required rappelling down by line. I used just one unbreakable rule. The trail had to be fully prepared from one turnaround base to the next before a wagon was moved. Minerva. It was so confounded slow that my calendar caught up with me. The sow littered, and we were not out of the mountains. I don't recall ever making a harder decision. Dora was in good shape, but she was halfway through her pregnancy. Turn back, as I had promised myself, without telling her, or push on, and hope to reach lower and fairly level ground before she came to term. Which would be easier on her? I had to consult her, but I had to decide. Responsibility cannot be shared. I knew how she would vote before I took the matter up with her. Push on. But that would be simply her gallant courage. I was the one with experience both in wilderness trekking and in childbirth problems. I studied those photo maps again without learning anything new. Somewhere ahead, the gorge opened out into a broad river valley. But how far? I didn't know because I didn't know where we were. We had started with an odometer on the right rear wheel of the lead wagon. I had reset it to zero at the pass, and it had lasted only a day or two. A rock or something did it in. I didn't even know how much altitude we had managed to drop since the pass, or how much more we must lose to get down. Livestock and equipment? Fair. We had lost two mules. Pretty girl had wandered over the edge one night and broken a leg. All I could do for her was put her out of her misery. I didn't butcher her because we had fresh meat, and I could not do it where the other mules could not see it anyhow. John Barleycorn had simply upped and died one night, or possibly lost to a loper. He was partly eaten when we found him. Three hens were dead, and two piglets failed to make it, but the sow seemed willing to suckle the others. I had only two spare wheels left, lose two more, and the next broken wheel meant abandoning one wagon. It was the wheels that made up my mind. Omitted. Approximately 7,000 words, which reiterate difficulties in getting down the gorge. When we came out on that plateau, we could see the valley stretching out before us. A beautiful valley, Minerva. Wide and green and lovely. Thousands and thousands of hectares of ideal farmland. The river from the gorge, tame now, meandered lazily between low banks. Facing us, a long, long way off, was a high peak crowned with snow. Its snow line let me guess how high it was, around 6,000 meters, for we had now dropped down into subtropics, and only a very high mountain could keep so much snow through a long and very hot summer. That beautiful mountain, that lush green valley, gave me a feeling of deja vu. Then I placed it. Mount Hood, in the land of my birth, back on old earth, as I had first seen it as a young man. But this valley, this snow-capped peak, had never before been seen by men. I called out to Buck to halt the march. Dorable? We're home. Inside of it, somewhere down in that valley. Home, she repeated. Oh, my darling. Don't sniffle. I wasn't sniffling, she answered, sniffling. But I've got an awful good cry saved up, and when I get time to, I'm going to use it. All right, dear, I agreed. When you have time. Let's name that mountain Dora Mountain. She looked thoughtful. No, that's not its name. That's Mount Hope. And all this below is Happy Valley. Durable Dora, you're incurably sentimental. You should talk. She patted her belly, swollen almost to term. That's Happy Valley because it's where I'm going to have this hungry little beast. and that's Mount Hope, because it is. Buck had come back to the first wagon and was waiting to find out why we had stopped. "Buck," I said, pointing, "that's home out there. We made it. Home, boy. Farm." Buck looked out over the valley. "Okay." He went in his sleep, Minerva. Not lopers. There wasn't a mark on Buck. Massive coronary, I think, although I didn't cut him open to find out. He was simply old and tired. Before he left, I tried to put him in the pasture with John Magee. But Buck didn't want that. We were his family, Dora and Beulah and I, and he wanted to come along. So I made him mule boss and didn't work him. I mean, I never rode him and never had him in harness. He did work as mule boss, and his patient good judgment got us safely to Happy Valley. We would not have made it without him. Maybe he could have lived a few years longer, turned out to pasture. Or he might have pined away from loneliness soon after we left. Who's to judge? I didn't even consider butchering him. I think Dora would have miscarried if I'd so much as broached the idea. But it is foolish to bury a mule when lopers and weather will soon take care of his carcass. So I buried him. It takes a hellacious big hole to bury a mule, and if it hadn't been soft river-bottom loam, I'd be there yet. But first I had to deal with personnel problems. Ken was just junior to Beulah in the water queue and was a steady, strong mule who talked fairly well. On the other hand, Beulah had been Buck's straw boss the whole trek. But I could not recall a gang of mules bossed by a mare. Minerva, with Homo sapiens, this would not matter, at least not today on Secundus, but with some sorts of animals, it does matter. A boss elephant is female. A boss chicken is a cock, not a hen. A boss dog can be either sex. In a breed where sex controls the matter, a man had better by a damn sight go along with their ways. I decided to see if Beulah could swing it, so I told her to line him up for harness, both as a test and because I wanted to move the mules out of sight while I buried Buck. They were nervy and restless. The boss mule's death had upset them. I don't know what mules think about death, but they are not indifferent to it. She promptly got busy, and I kept an eye on Kenny. He accepted it, took his usual place by Daisy. Once I had him harnessed, Beulah was the only one left over. Three mules dead now. I told Dora that I wanted them moved a few hundred meters away. Would she handle it with Beulah as march boss? Or would she feel safer if I did it? And ran into a second problem. Dora wanted to be present when I buried Buck. More than that, Woodrow, I can help dig. Buck was my friend too, you know. I said, Dora, I'll put up with anything at all from a pregnant woman, except allowing her to do something that would hurt her. But dearest, I feel okay physically. It's just that I'm dreadfully upset over Buck, so I want to help. I think you are in good shape, too, and I want you to stay that way. You can help best by staying in the wagon. Though I haven't any way to take care of a premature baby, and I don't want to have to bury a baby as well as Buck. Her eyes widened. You think that would happen? Sweetheart, I don't know. I've known women to hang on to babies under unbelievable hardships. I've seen others lose babies for no reason that I could see. The only rule I have about it is, don't take unnecessary chances. This one is not necessary. So once again, we replanned things to suit both of us, though it took an extra hour. I unshackled the second wagon and set up the fence again, put the four goats inside the fence and left Dora in that wagon. Then I drove the first wagon 300 or 400 meters away, unharnessed the mules, and told Beulah to keep them together, and told Ken to help her. I left Fritz to help her, too, and took Lady Mac back with me to watch for lopers or whatever. The visibility was good. No brush, no high grass. The place looked like a tended park. But I was going to be down in a hole. I didn't want something sneaking up on me or on the wagon. Lady Macbeth, high sentry, up. By agreement, Dora stayed in the wagon. It took all that day to take care of our old friend. with a stop for lunch and a few short breaks for water and to catch my breath in the shade of the wagon. Breaks I shared with Lady Mac, letting her get down each time I came up. Plus, one interruption. It was mid-afternoon, and I had dug almost enough hole when Lady Mac barked for me. I was up out of that hole fast, blaster in hand, expecting lopers. Just a dragon. I wasn't especially surprised, Minerva. The well-cropped state of the turf, almost like a lawn, seemed to indicate dragon rather than prairie goat. Those dragons are not dangerous unless one happens to fall on you. They're slow, stupid, and strictly vegetarian. Oh, they're ugly enough to be frightening. They look like six-legged triceratops. But that's all. Lopers left them alone because biting armor is unrewarding. I joined Dora at the wagon. Ever seen one, hun? Not up close. Goodness, it's huge. It's a big one, all right, but it will probably turn away. I won't waste a charge on it if I don't have to. But the darn thing did not turn away. Minerva, I think it was so stupid that it mistook the wagon for a lady dragon. Or the other way around. It is hard to tell male from female. But they are definitely bisexual. Two dragons humping is a remarkable sight. When it got within 100 meters, I let myself out the fence and took Lady Macbeth along, as she was quiveringly eager. I doubt if she'd ever seen one. They were cleaned out around Top Dollar long before she was whelped. She danced up to it, barking but wary. I hoped that Lady would cause it to turn aside, but this misshapen rhinoceros paid no attention. It lumbered slowly along, straight for the wagon. So I tickled it with my needle gun between where it should have had lips to get its attention. It stopped, astounded, I think, and opened its mouth wide. That was what I needed, as it did not want to waste maximum power blasting through that armored hide. So, blaster at minimum, right into its mouth. Scratch, one dragon. It stood there a moment, then slowly collapsed. I called Lady and went back to the fence. Dora was waiting. May I go look at it? I glanced at the sun. Sweetheart, I'm going to be pushed to take care of Buck before dark, then fetch the mules back and move us on away. Unless you are willing to bivouac with the grave on one side and a dead dragon on the other. She did not insist, and I got back to work. In another hour, I had it deep enough and wide enough, got out block and tackle, a triple purchase, secured it to the rear axle, tied Buck's hind feet together, hooked over the tie, and took up the slack. Dora had come out with me. Just a moment, dear. She stopped to pat Buck's neck, then leaned down and kissed his forehead. All right, Woodrow, now. I heaved on the line. For a moment, I thought the wagon would move despite the brakes being locked. Then Buck started to slide and fell into his grave. I shook the hook loose, then backfilled fast. Closing in 20 minutes a hole, it had taken me most of the day to dig. Dora waited. I finished. Up in the wagon, Dorable. That's it. Lazarus, I wish I knew something to say. Do you? I thought about it. I heard 1,000 burial services. Most of them I did not like, so I made up one. Whatever God there be, please take care of this fine person. He always did his best. Amen. Even those first years weren't too hard, as Happy Valley would grow anything. Two, three crops a year, but we should have named it Dragon Valley. Lopers were bad enough, especially the small lopers that hunted in packs, which we found on that side of Rampart Range. But those damn dragons, they almost drove me out of my skull. When you've lost the same potato patch 4 times running, it begins to wear. Lopers I could poison, and did. I could trap them, too, if I changed style every time. Or I could put out bait at night and sit quietly and get most of a pack, silently, with a needle gun. I could do lots of things, and did. And the mules learned to cope with them, too, sleeping closer together at night and always with one on watch, like quail or baboon. Whenever I heard the bellow that meant loper, I always came awake fast and tried to join the fun, but the mules rarely left me any. They not only could stomp 'em, but they could outrun 'em and get some or all of a pack that tried to escape. We lost 3 mules and 6 goats to lopers, but the lopers got the news and started giving us a wide berth.
But those dragons, too big to trap and would not take poison. Salad was all they were after. But what one dragon can do to a cornfield in one night shouldn't happen to some.